Hello and welcome to the FinTech Newscast. My name's John, and this week we'll be talking about the Bay Area. Not San Francisco, not Boston, but the Shenzhen Bay Area. FinTech cybersecurity comes up in the news again, and 9 reasons why bigger banks are here to stay. Please hit subscribe to keep up with these and the latest in FinTech news. All right, great. Let's get started. Lots of good stuff as usual this week. Never boring in FinTech land. And with me this week to talk about it is Sean.
Hey, John. Happy to be here.
Great. And Steve.
Hello, everyone.
Let's get started with Shenzhen. It's kind of like the Silicon Valley of China, but they want to get even bigger?
Yeah. Did you hear about this? The Hong Kong riots. You couldn't have missed this in the news.
The peaceful protests to ensure their rights that they were promised?
Yeah, and the extradition issue that they're fighting for. A fifth of their population came out, of Hong Kong's population came out last weekend. If you saw the pictures, insane.
Really, I never saw so many umbrellas before.
Yeah, exactly. All in one place. But China, in a move to slight Hong Kong, is trying to bolster Shenzhen with some of its more recent policies unveiled this week. They're giving favorable treatment to Shenzhen companies by better connecting them with other partners in China. And so what does this mean? It means that fintechs in the city like WeBank, which is China's first digital bank.
Yeah, so part of the WeChat and the Tencent ecosystem, right?
Yeah, I believe so, as well as TenPay. So that's a B2B, a B2C payments platform that connects like with your utility payments. It's all this part of this project for Chinese cities to become more connected. So what China's doing here, the Communist Party, is favoring those companies, in this case fintech companies in Shenzhen, by helping them with privileges.
So encouraging capitalism.
Encouraging, yeah, exactly. Fair treatment. And this is something that the Chinese government's been doing, right? Using fiscal policy to for its preferred players. You see, like, a lot of the big banks and financial institutions here in the U.S. have predicted this. Goldman predicted this in 2019 that China's going to double down on its strategy to leverage this as a bargaining chip, their fiscal policy as a bargaining chip, to give unfair advantage to certain players. So look out for Shenzhen. It's the Bay Area that we've got to keep an eye out on. There's a lot of things happening.
So this Shenzhen linking up with Hong Kong and the other cities in that area for this Bay Area project, does this involve a lot of infrastructure as well?
It's more financial markets. So it's more about connecting financial markets between Shenzhen, Hong Kong, and Macau.
That makes sense. So it's basically a way to maybe replace Hong Kong as the center of international finance in the region with Shenzhen, right?
Yeah, they're trying to slight Hong Kong by saying, hey, look, like, you guys want to play games? We're going to make Shenzhen cooler than you, the coolest kid on the block.
Yeah, possibly. Shenzhen, I just saw that the GDP in Shenzhen is already like the same size or even a little bit bigger than Hong Kong. So that's kind of a...
Why is that?
Oh, Shenzhen is like the tech capital of China. So a lot of business. It's I love seeing those pictures of opening up China in Shenzhen. It's like looks like farmland, right?
Right.
And then 1980, and then the pictures now, it's like a
skyscraper.
It looks like Manhattan, right?
Yeah.
Just huge. And that's all the tech industry. You can build just about anything out of the suppliers there. The network is huge there. So Hong Kong, this is kind of bad news for Hong Kong because they're not as special anymore. They're not as important to mainland communist Chinese leaders.
Are they, though? I mean, the protests have been going on for, what, 11 weeks now?
11 weeks, yeah.
I think it takes more than, call it 3 months for you to actually stand up a city as a financial center of East Asia, right?
Yeah.
It took about 5 weeks before the Tiananmen Square protesters got dispersed, shall we say?
Yeah.
So this is going on already longer than that occurred. So they have been kind of, holding back a little bit because they know the world is watching. But it looks pretty bad.
Yeah, and I think they're certainly adopting more of a long-term vision here. I mean, I think the Chinese government understands that this trade war is going to continue, and they need to do things to protect the downside. So the Eurasia Group predicted that this trade war probably is going to continue even through 2020 through November 2020. So the Chinese know that these conflicts will continue. These things are going to be an issue for the Chinese government. So what they need to do is protect the downside and bolster up one of their more favorable cities like Shenzhen to kind of slight Hong Kong in a way.
Yeah. So, but this is funny because this implies that you can basically take a lot of the regulatory things that make Hong Kong so attractive to international investors and companies and transport it into Shenzhen, which I think is kind of a longer term proposition.
Yeah, I think there's certainly a desire to concentrate a lot of the activity in Shenzhen and make it the model for growth in China. Because of the conflicts right now in Hong Kong, they're saying, hey, look, let's just go ahead and double down on Shenzhen.
All right, yeah, we'll keep an eye on that going forward. Another big threat for all fintechs and every financial institution, actually, is the threat of cybersecurity. We talked about an interesting example at Coinbase. Was it a week or 2 weeks ago?
It was last week.
Last week, we talked about that. But there's a new article talking about how almost all fintechs are exposed in some way, have vulnerabilities to cyber incidents. And these are kind of straightforward things, but I imagine with the million details that go into creating your fintech, that some of these basic things like setting up your firewall properly, having all the settings that can possibly be set to the right place, that some of the things are gonna slip through the cracks. And, you know, cybersecurity, you know, everyone takes it seriously, but, you know, fintechs are just getting started. They're worried about their products. They're worried about their marketing. They're hiring like crazy.
They want to move fast and break things.
They're moving fast and trying not to break things, but there's so many things that could go wrong. And security is, of course, one of them. And they're doing a reasonably good job based on this study from ImmuniWeb. They say 98% of the world's top 100 fintechs are vulnerable to web and mobile application attacks, despite all the money and the generally newer software and capabilities that they're providing. Some of the most common things that they found are cross-site scripting. I have no idea what that means, but apparently it's a known thing that can be remedied, they say, But the vulnerability is what they've seen in a lot of these fintechs. Data exposure and security misconfiguration. So kind of not paying attention to, like I said, all the things that they need to set up.
I think this actually is a fairly common project. I know that you know, sometime in late July of this year, Monzo, the big UK-based neobank, had an outage that left customers unable to either make payments or even use the ATM.
How do I pay for my meat pies, though?
How do you get your bangers and mash when you don't have access to that? Yeah,
right.
And I think that it's happened to Monzo. It's happened to Revolut in the UK. We saw attempts against Coinbase, as you mentioned last week. I think that this is sort of an overlooked part of fintech, is that it's not as secure, some would argue, as what the big banks have. The big banks, as slow as they are, have that infrastructure and have the protocols and just the headcount.
Right, right. That's one of the things they say is one of the advantages they have, besides using newer software and you know, and being able to hire some of the best people, is that they're simpler. They don't have all the complex interactions that large banks have. And considering that complexity, that large banks are doing a reasonable job. It's just that that story that we've seen across all of these vulnerabilities, it just takes one out of 10,000 attempts and attacks and people checking your vulnerabilities.
One hack
to succeed. Yeah, that's right. They have to be right. The fintech or the bank has to be right 10,000 times, mm-hmm. and the hacker just has to be right once.
That's right. The Dua Lipa's coming out with a new song called One Breach Is All It Takes.
That's a good
so
one.
They said in this study, they said all of the mobile applications tested can contain at least one security vulnerability of a medium risk. And 97% have at least two medium or high-risk vulnerabilities. And these are, they said that there's also misconfigurations with that as well, or privacy issues related to their SSL and TLS configurations.
So I wonder how this actually, so I understand what the issue is, but I wonder how this compares to what a similar study would find for a bigger bank. Is it also where you have 99% of banks also having all these security flaws that could be exploited, or is it just more of a fintech thing? It's difficult for me to have this to benchmark
to
this
compare
study. Exactly. Yeah.
Well, they said 98% have some, so it's almost everybody,
which is fairly high. But what if all the banks in the U.S. have the same issues?
Yeah, I'm sure they do.
Then do you just store a certain amount of gold or cash in your house in a vault
as
a backup?
That seems like the solution.
That seems like 100% vulnerable to a break-in.
We have optionality, right?
There's been break-ins where somebody said that they had a safe in the back of their closet. They said they didn't tell anybody, and they didn't tell anybody the combination. They leave the house, and boom, it's broken into. So I don't know how people find a way to get to your stuff, but
somehow it happens.
Somehow it happens. And when you're not just against the neighborhood, you're basically against the whole world of hackers. That's a tough bill to fill.
As long as you're not prone to one single point of attack. I think if you have optionality and you have a kind of an anti-fragile mindset where you're like, I'm going to put a little here, maybe I'll experiment with this small fintech that could be a little risky, but I'll put, you know, half a percent of my net worth into this project or something like that.
Right. Yeah.
And then you spread it out to like a big bank, maybe have some actual.
That's kind of like a
real
estate.
And
like, it's a bad situation to be in, right? It's like saying, it's like a pre-insurance banking days. I'm going to put my deposits in a bunch of banks. So, because if some of them fail, I'll have like that's not a great answer, actually.
You don't think so? I think
so. Having good security is probably a better.
But
you know,
that's
a better
boring
answer.
And expensive. You want a cool product manager. You want a cool designer. You want
people
with mohawks
or
doing cool things.
Just get insurance. Yeah. So some of the things that ImmuneWeb recommends is having an inventory of all your assets, of course, that lists out all your what they call external attack surfaces. Implement continuous security monitoring, and the cool and sexy thing, of course, use machine learning and AI to handle time-consuming and routine processes so that your security team can focus on more important things.
Easy for you to say.
Yeah, right. Just put AI on it. No problem.
On there.
On those boring jobs. No problem. Because, I could see that where you're configuring, 20 different systems. You have security for each one, all the interactions. I mean, some things are inevitably seems like going to get missed unless you're testing against that, right?
Yeah.
So good luck out there, fintech people, and lock your doors when you leave the house.
Or store gold.
Or store gold. Or buy rocks. All right. So if you don't want to do that, why should you even bother with an old school bank, Steve?
Why should you? Actually, I feel that this is sort of the negative on fintech podcast, but there's a really interesting blog post on Finextra that highlighted the 9 reasons why you shouldn't bet against the bigger banks. And I'm going to go through them fairly quickly.
So is it kind of a good argument for what fintechs have to overcome if they want to take more and more of the market?
Right, or I guess on the flip side, an argument as to why maybe the fintech threat is a bit overblown in a way. And these are not MISI, for all you consulting nerds, these are not MISI reasons, but they're still kind of interesting.
I only deal with MISI, Steve.
Only MISI.
MISI? Yeah. What's MISI?
Mutually exclusive.
Collectively exhaustive.
Bam!
Ah,
yeah.
Okay. A statistics kind of a thing in there?
No, it's just a way to build decks if you're a consultant like
MISI.
Sean and I used to
I
be.
Never heard that word.
MEC,
I thought you said MISIKs, like the Rick and Morty thing. Oh, these are not MISIKs.
These are not
I'm going to solve your little problems for you. Oh, okay.
It's
just a list. Okay, got it.
It's just a list, yeah. I'll go through them fairly quickly. Number one, there are still lots of low-tech consumers. This makes sense. A lot of banks have this issue where they're, no matter how beautiful and powerful your mobile services become or your web services become, a big portion of your customer base just does not want to do stuff online, right? They're not really interested in doing stuff on the internet.
That number probably will be reducing, right? I mean,
I think
a lot of that is
I think a lot of that is based on demographics, right? So the older segments, and it's also based on people who maybe live in an area where they just don't have access to good internet, so they have to go to the branch, or they just want to go to the branch. Number two, all banking is local. Some people actually like the experience of going to a bank, saying hi to Bob, doing transactions, right? That's something that most fintechs cannot really offer. They're all based on efficiency and scale and speediness.
Well, there's always going to be something to being able to look someone in the eye when they're robbing you.
Absolutely.
Until we're all robots.
Like when you buy your used car.
Yeah. Number three, and also kind of related, not messy, but also related, the personal touch. For most consumers, when you want to do a big transaction, you don't want to deal in some cases with a digital-only platform. You may want to go
through
to
the phone tree where you got to click 915 and...
Exactly. It makes sense for you to just go to the branch.
Especially when you have a problem. Yeah, sure.
Exactly.
Yeah.
With a problem, I do not want to talk to a freaking chatbot. Just give me a person.
You know what sucks is if you go to a physical store and then they call... someone to help solve the problem.
Oh my God, that is the worst.
Well, at least you don't have to listen to hold music, right?
They listen to the hold music for you.
Exactly. Outsource the listening to
the personal touch.
My favorite is a dreaded one where you have to connect two parties, like two companies together in one conference call so they can figure it out. It's gonna send them. That's my absolute favorite. Number four, fintech is focused on niches, price link savings, gold space savings, payments, crypto,
small
whatever.
Small business
is very niche focused, whereas a bank will give you a wide array of services ranging from...
And do them all badly.
And do them all badly, but at least do them all.
Yeah.
Ranging from consumer deposits all the way to commercial banking, right? Not something you really see in fintech. Number five, regulation is not all bad. I think we've all learned this, right? We all understand that it's difficult to get a banking charter in the U.S., although now we have, you know, things like sandboxes, and that makes sense. But being overseen by the FDIC is a good thing for banks because it means that you're not operating beyond the realms of what's risky. Again, you have a lot of oversight, and it's just a better way to run a business.
Yeah, if you're against that kind of regulation, well, you probably were, like all of us, born after the bank failures were like a regular thing. I mean, really, not just the Depression, but before that, any bank could just go out of business and make off with your money, just like you see in other countries that are less regulated.
True.
So kind of like vaccines. You forget anybody was ever sick, so you think it's not possible anymore, but... there's a reason for that.
Absolutely. Number six, artificial intelligence is amazing. We understand that AI will transform things like trading. And
a lot of my coworkers have artificial intelligence.
Oh, they do?
Yeah. It's definitely not real intelligence, that's for sure.
It's not real intelligence, yeah. But yeah, this is something that I think most banks can leverage now to kind of improve their products and services and compete with the fintech challengers. Number seven, banking is more than a mobile wallet. Again, we're going back to that thing, right? Where we all use payments, we all use Venmo and contactless payments and Apple Pay, whatever, all that stuff. That's cool for a certain segment of the population, not as much for all of us. So, you know, all these fintechs really key on having this amazing mobile experiences, but not all people want that experience.
That number might decrease, would you say, as well?
That will also decrease. I think this is sort of a snapshot. This is all
current
this
state.
Is a plate. Yeah, this current state right now, but that number will certainly go down.
Yeah, no, like with my parents, for example, like I think, you know, in the beginning of the mobile access days, they were a little skeptical, like a lot of people in their generation were, where, you know, you're gaining access to your bank account on your phone. It takes a little bit of getting used to, but so I see that point.
Certainly. Number eight, co-opting. This actually is really important. A lot of the big banks in the U.S., especially the big four, they all have, you know, innovation groups and incubators and accelerators. So they're not, of course, they're slower than fintechs to actually take up new things, but they're able to catch up, right? They're able to actually do things that are more technologically advanced. So I think that they benefit from the competition, you know, by basically having to catch up with the challengers.
Like technology gets kind of normalized, right?
Exactly.
So like maybe a mobile app was like a cutting edge thing at one point, but now it's
15 years
thing.
Ago, but now it's regular.
And now,
I know
just like an iPhone is not a big deal now. When
exactly
early on, getting your email was like people said, oh, there's crackberries, and that was such an unusual thing.
I remember that, absolutely, yeah. So now it's, you
the
know...
The crack or the
The phone,
okay.
the crackberry, not the actual crack.
Yeah.
But, you know, one example is that a lot of these new neobanks leverage chatbots, right, which is pretty cool, pretty interesting. But now we see even B of A now has a chatbot called Erica. So it's become sort of commonplace. So, you know, banks are slow and lumbering, but they can actually catch up and do things as well. And the last reason is actually a bubble. I think that, you know, this is something that we're going to touch up during our final bite. But there's kind of been a fintech bubble. And, you know, customers really are all that keen on putting their money into a place that could be seen as a frothy investment or sort of a frothy, nascent fly-by-night operation. So, again, that trust in having a well-known name is really crucial. And I think it's one of the reasons why, potentially, we should not be betting against the bigger banks.
Do you think the not being keen on putting their money into fintechs. Do you think that trend will continue, or do you think it'll reverse?
No, I think these are all snapshots based on sort of where we are now. But I think that in 15, 20 years, there may be new reasons. Mm-hmm. But as the older segment moves off the banking sector, I guess, or just mm-hmm. dies off, is a way to put it, I think that we'll see a lot more adoption of newer things. But again, I think that a lot of the structural things we see here, are like the bank's ability to catch up, the fact that they do have money, the fact that they can also leverage technology, maybe not as well, but similarly close to what another fintech would do, are reasons why we shouldn't quite say that banking is dead as it stands now.
I don't know if it's just like older people. These are good reasons. If you want to see somebody in person when there's a problem,
right,
there's nowhere to go. Mm-hmm. I've seen a lot of the tech companies, not just fintechs, they don't have a phone number you can call. They just have a form. Or it's better if they have like a chat, someone you can chat with.
Zendesk. Least. I hate Zendesk so much.
At least that's like a live person that can help you.
Right.
Zendesk. You hate. You don't have Zen when you use Zendesk.
No, I do not. I've had issues with a company where I have to email them or go through Zendesk, and it takes like 3 days. And it's like if it was a big company, I could just call them. There's a contact center in Texas. They just do it. Bada bing, bada boom. It's done.
You go to a Chase office. You can get a hold of them or call them
24/7, and they're always there.
I love how it's called Zendesk. That's like being like angry that your meditation app is not working. I need my meditation app to work.
I should be more relaxed.
Come on.
Not quite Zen.
But it takes just one or two times to get burned. So like Venmo, you can't undo the payment once you send it to someone, and there's scams around that. You go back, you don't trust that method anymore. Your Robinhood trade doesn't go well. They didn't provide any advice, so you go back to somewhere that's more reliable, and maybe that means in person, or I don't know if it's just an older segment that can't handle the technology, but there's some risks as well with that.
Yeah.
And if your phone is lost or stolen, you're also locked out for a little while, and that's a problem too.
Yeah, the trust is so fragile with these fintechs. So, it only takes that one or two, times of breach.
How many times does your checking account or your, you get robbed somehow that before you go, well, that maybe that branch isn't so old-fashioned after all. That's not such a bad thing.
Right, right.
So, interesting. Thanks. I love the list, Steve.
Thank you.
Yeah.
It's out of my making, but thank you.
Okay. And now it's time for our final bite, where we take a look at a number and the fascinating story behind it. Steve, why don't you keep us going?
All right, so my final bite is $22 billion. It's a big number, right?
It is a big number.
That is the amount of money, the total value of all the deals struck all over the world in fintech investing globally in the first half of 2019.
That sounds pretty great. Jeez. If you got some of that money.
It sounds awesome. Yeah. The only issue is that for the same period last year, so the first half of 2018, total funding for fintech was $31.2 billion. So a precipitous decline in funding in fintech across the globe. Of course, there are some caveats, right? Funding has actually been up in the US and the UK. This is mostly in China and across the globe. But it's just being said, there may be a slowdown in fintech afoot. We'll see.
Yeah, he seems kind of hesitant, even though the funding is up in the US by a good amount. But the Accenture, is it, that did this report?
It is, yeah.
They don't sound very positive going forward, like things will flatten out, mostly because of the trade war and kind of a growing problems with that?
Yeah, I think the trade war can be blamed on a lot of things, and I think the fintech funding could be one of those things as well.
You also look at a lot of the international financial think tanks and institutions are predicting that this will actually probably go on for a while, that this trade war is going to go on for a while. You look at the Eurasia Group predicting this will probably happen through 2020. So this means that these effects can persist through next year. So keep an eye out for that. But certainly, I think a cause of this will be the deteriorating relations between U.S. and China.
So close your funding rounds right away as soon as you can. Things are not going to get better. Yeah.
Ink that paper, my friend.
There was a little bit less traffic this morning. I think it's because of the trade war.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I blame everything on the trade war.
Makes sense.
That's right.
Sean, what's your number?
So 71% is my number. It's the, this is hilarious, it's the percentage of millennials who'd rather go to the dentist than listen to what banks have to say, according to a Millennial Disruption Index.
It's a, do, that was do a millennials 3-year, go to the dentist?
They do. They have to. Yeah. They just require those too much of that the candy, the, you know, Candy Crush and yeah. and actual physical candy. They need to get those fillings. So this is a study done of 10,000 millennials. And it's an interesting number, right? I mean, Steve was earlier talking about how there's that longevity of the big banks, right? That we're going to continue with kind of doubling down on those models because they're more stable. So kind of contrary to that, there's been a recent wave of narratives by, you know, reputable news sources like NASDAQ and Washington Post that has really urged people to start looking at credit unions. Why? I mean, credit unions are really interesting. I'm recently getting hot on these credit unions.
Are credit unions always nonprofits?
Yes.
They are. And yeah. The cool thing about credit unions is that you're a member and a part owner. So, like, you technically own part of that bank, and any profit that a credit union earns is invested back.
I go in and try to fire people. So yeah,
that's right. You're fired. but the profit you share that profit with your other members, right? And another thing that's cool about credit unions is that could be paid out in dividends. Also, you can do a lot of more interesting donation and nonprofit work. So, like, for millennials, this could be an ideal choice if they want to give back to something that aligns with their values. So credit unions are more of an interesting trend that I'm seeing. And this number,
you're up on the credit union. Maybe I should set up an online credit union instead of an online bank.
Well, yeah. I mean, think about that. If you can kind of capitalize on this,
that
you can capitalize on this you know this new sort of wave of millennials wanting to invest in things that align their values. You're a member or an owner of that bank, a part owner of that bank. You get paid out in dividends.
Somehow, my salary will be massive, but it'll still be a nonprofit.
I mean whatever you know makes you happy, but the point here is I think that there's some really interesting momentum in the credit union space. Also, as you mentioned, John, digitizing some of that could be an interesting opportunity for fintechs to look at.
But I gotta say, I think this is more of a culture issue than a tech issue. I think that a lot of the movement towards credit unions is because people see the value in supporting a local union where they are part members, as opposed to a big bank where they have no real stake in the company. So it's more, you know, we recorded this on Tuesday, and it came out today that a bunch of top CEOs like Jamie Dimon and Bezos said that their companies will no longer key in on shareholder value as a driving force behind every decision. And I think that speaks to a larger macro trend about people kind of focusing on the other side,
responsible.
Exactly.
Yeah,
economy.
Yeah. And
thank you. Yeah.
The banks, you know, to your point, are starting to catch on to this, and they know that to get this new base.
Just barely. Just recently.
Just recently.
Starting recording this on Tuesday, so today.
So today.
It's never before.
Yeah. Exactly. It's a hold on to that salary for as long as we can. But I mean, I think in a way, it's a survivalist technique, right?
Yes.
I mean, they've got to appeal to this new wave of millennials. They're seeing this demographic shift of their customer base, so they need to make an adjustment where they can. But I think this is also an opportunity for these sorts of like digitized credit unions to come in and say, hey, look, like this narrative of the big bank, here's another narrative where you can you know align with your values better. You can be a part owner of the bank, get paid out in dividends when the bank does well.
Yep.
It's a very attractive opportunity.
So yeah, an interesting trend, Steve. And another trend that's going on is a move towards Toronto, where it's $71,000 cheaper on average to hire a computer engineer compared to the San Francisco Bay Area.
That is fascinating. I'm assuming that the relationship between quality and price is in linear, right?
I don't think they're half as good as, they're probably just
about as good.
Just about as good, right?
But they cost half as much.
They cost just about half as much, right. The average computer engineer is about $145,000 salary in the San Francisco Bay Area, compared to $74,000. I will add only $74,000, and it's not Canadian dollars. This is American dollars to American dollars in Toronto. And this is attracted because the quality, as you point out, is as good or nearly so as ones that you would find in other tech centers like New York and Chicago. Toronto is actually the fourth largest North American city, which I didn't know.
New York, Chicago, LA, Toronto? or New York, LA, Houston.
Mexico City?
Mexico City.
Is that if they include North America?
So that's Mexico City, New York, Houston, Toronto?
Something like that.
Makes sense.
I'm going to trust the article on that one. But this has attracted people on the finance side that's supporting these VC investments. So Silicon Valley Bank has opened its first office in Toronto as of March 2019. And they used to service their Canadian clients out of the Seattle and Boston offices, you know, close to the border, obviously. But now they say that with their diverse population, Canada is a very diverse country, much like the United States, but easier to bring in immigrant talent these days. So a little bit better on the visa front.
They also have very somewhat restrictive immigration policies, which we're not going to get into, but yeah.
And you know what? I didn't know that Toronto was in the final round to get the one of the new Amazon headquarters, but they were being considered in there.
Look at that.
As well. And much like many of the other losers in the final round, they're getting Amazon's throwing some offices their way anyway. So they expect about 113,000 square foot of office space that Amazon will be opening up there and hiring out of that office. And a lot of other companies, Salesforce, Google, have presence there and are expanding as well. So, you know, we always have well wishes for our Canadian neighbors to the north. And if you're listening, good job, eh? All right. I think that's enough for this episode, right? of the FinTech Newscast. Please hit subscribe to keep up with the latest in FinTech news, which we'll always bring to you. And thanks a lot for listening.
Thanks, John. See you.
See you later.